And you're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ LP 103.3 FM in Northampton. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. It is Tuesday, August 18th, says the calendar. And I'm going to play a little Peter Tosh while I organize some of my thoughts that I want to share for today. Sorry, no, I meant to play this thing. Sorry, now I've got two going at once. Oh, computers.
Live up to your expectations. Neither are you here to live up to mine. Yeah. I don't owe no one, no obligation. No one owe me none, so everything is fine. Fine. I said, I am that I am. I am.
Peter Tosh, I Am That I Am, from 1977. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. So Out There airs every Tuesday now from 3 until 4. Well, it did, but August, this is my last month of Out There for a while. So I got a few more shows, and I was playing some repeats. But for today's show, I've been thinking about something. I came across this reading during the week that I was just looking for something inspiring. And this is called The Weapon of Love, How Martin Luther King Jr. Became Nonviolent by Stanley Hauerwas. And he's a divinity and law professor at Duke. This is from January 2017, and I found it online. But he quotes all sorts of different people and stuff, and it starts out quoting John Howard Yoder from 1983, talking about nonviolence, about Christian nonviolence specifically. And I just want to read this opening quote that really resonated with me. John Howard Yoder says, "One of the most original cultural products of our century is our awareness of the power of organized nonviolent resistance as an instrument in the struggle for justice. One characteristic of this instrument is that its operation is often informal and decentralized. By the nature of the case, it does not create institutions of great visible power. Therefore, it's not easy for the historians to take account of, as they can tell the stories of military battles and the changing of regimes. Even of those who see happening some of the visible phenomena of nonviolent action are often not sufficiently aware of the history behind them to recognize that this phenomenon is not an oddity or an accident, but the product of a religious and cultural historical development." When I read that quote, it resonated with me a lot, because I grew up in a Christian home with those kinds of values, and I left Christianity when I was about 17. I moved to Chicago when I was 19 and joined the Catholic Worker Movement, moved into a Catholic Worker house, which the Catholic Worker Movement, that's the kind of Catholics who would kind of get kicked out of the Christian church for, I don't know, being gay or being too liberal or radical, yeah, or advocating for anarchy or anarchists, you know, instead of the Catholic power structure, that kind of thing. And so since I left Chicago in 2002 and I moved to Northampton, I haven't really, you know, been steeped in the type of spiritually motivated, nonviolent thinking, action, thought, and mentality with the groups that I was with in Chicago. And I kind of missed that a little bit, but it still is with me. Growing up, my dad was a preacher. My mom was even kind of more religious, I would say, but we were raised to believe that God had a purpose for us, and a big part of that purpose was, how can we serve others? And all of, like, love one another and things like that. The thing that I've been thinking about a lot today, just a few different things that have come across my wavelengths through my life. So a few weeks ago, okay, I'll start with this one. Okay, so a few weeks ago, there was an Amazon Prime package that got dropped off on our front porch. And it wasn't for any of us. The address was a different street in Florence, different name, different street, no one that we knew. And so we tried to return it to the driver, get the driver to pick it up and redeliver it. Apparently my housemate had some interaction with the driver where they're like, we can't find it on our GPS. So it sat on our front porch for a while. There's like 7 of us who live there, and no one really, you know, took initiative to do anything about it. So finally, after a couple weeks, I looked up the person's name online, and they're this doctor. And so I sent a message on the online website to their like doctor office or something. Meanwhile, one of my housemates is like, it's been a couple weeks already. She probably has another one. Amazon's probably already sent her another one by now. We should probably just keep it or whatever. Anyway, so I sent her a message. That was like a week ago. Didn't hear back for a week. The thing is, normally I would deliver things like this, but it was kind of like in a suburb of Florence up a big hill, and I ride my bike everywhere, and I'm like, I just don't really feel like riding my bike out that way in a direction I never go to deliver this package. Plus, you know, on the side, I'm kind of like, plus, Amazon. I don't like Amazon. And I dislike Amazon Prime even more. Anyway, so, but then finally today, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to deliver this thing because I have the day off and I'm going to go for a fun bike ride somewhere I've never been. And part of me was like, well, should I deliver it? Should I just like open it? I wonder what it is. And I was like, well, you know what? There is nothing in the world I need. If I open this, then it becomes mine and my burden. Maybe she doesn't need it either, but I'm going to take it to her, and that can be her burden. And so I took it, and the address was at this short dead-end road off of Florence Road on the top of this hill with these mansions like I'd never really seen or not seen much. I guess they are in the suburbs of Florence and the outskirts of Florence a lot. And it was this ginormous house. And there was a woman in a car that was leaving as I pulled up, and I was like, hey, are you so-and-so? And she was like, she's inside, I think. She said, and the woman in the car said, oh, I'm the house cleaner. Anyway, so I just left the package, dropped the package and left. But that sort of situation ties into me, I don't know, thinking about these readings about nonviolence and all that. I'm going to read a little bit more here, and then I have another little story. Let's see. So this article is talking about King's and Gandhi's values of nonviolence and stuff. This is Yoder again. I don't believe that one honors Dr. King by assuming that somehow he had been prepared for this job. He had not been prepared for it, either tactically, strategically, or his understanding of nonviolence. The remarkable thing is that he came to a profoundly deep understanding of nonviolence through the struggle itself, and through reading and discussions which he had in the process of carrying on the protest. As he began to discuss nonviolence, as the newspapers throughout the country began to describe him as one who believed in nonviolence, he automatically took himself seriously because other people were taking him seriously. His understanding of nonviolence was always a work in process, a work in progress. So when I think about Martin Luther King's nonviolence, another key thing that I think about is when he talks about the evils of materialism, militarism, I think in poverty, I forget. But the materialism. So another thing, yesterday I was leaving somewhere that I spend a lot of time, and someone else who works there, they were leaving too. And I had just finished my pedal people route. I was all like hot and dirty and sweaty. I had my bike in the trailer, and I stopped. I was leaving Valley Recycling, and I stopped at the book drop-off bin where you could donate books, because I had some books to throw in there from a bookshop that I picked up at. And one of the books, I stopped to read it. And so I was standing there, straddling my bike, all dirty and hot and sweaty at the end of my workday, reading this book outside the book dumpster. And meanwhile, Valley Recycling had closed, and the people who work there, own it, work there, were leaving. And one of the people that works there, who I like, left, drove away in this car, this like really super fancy sports car. And I just, when I see that kind of thing, I just think, what kind of growing up or what kind of value system, what kind of reality do people live in that they would choose to put that many resources towards something that to me seems largely for show or image or something? It was very perplexing to me. All right. I'm going to play Peter Tosh again. Another Peter Tosh. And you're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. This is Downpresser Man.
Downpresser Man, where you gonna run to? Down. to be a flea. Under your collar, man, I wouldn't like to be a flea. Under your collar, man, I wouldn't like to be a flea.
Peter Tosh with Down Presser Man. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. I want to read some more of this article from The Weapon of Love, How Martin Luther King Jr. Became Nonviolent by Stanley Hauerwas from January 2017. This is from a website called ABC Religion and Ethics. And a lot of what I'm quoting is actually him quoting someone else, him quoting John Howard Yoder. In 1983. So let's see, is this a John Howard Yoder quote or not? No, this is actually a King quote from an article entitled Pilgrimage to Nonviolence that he wrote for the Christian Century in 1960. And King says, by being called to be a spokesman for his people, he was, another quote starts, he was driven back to the Sermon on the Mount and the Gandhian method of nonviolent resistance. This principle became the guiding light of our movement. Christ furnished the spirit and motivation, while Gandhi furnished the method. The experience of Montgomery did more to clarify my thinking on the question of nonviolence than all of the books I had read. As the days unfolded, I became more and more convinced of the power of nonviolence, living through the actual experience of the protest, Nonviolence became more than a method to which I gave intellectual assent. It became a commitment to a way of life. Many issues I had not cleared up intellectually concerning nonviolence were now solved in the sphere of practical action. So Martin Luther King goes on, like his sort of development, his sort of philosophy of nonviolence continues to be developed. So in a 1957 article for the Christian Century entitled Nonviolence and Racial Justice, he developed with clarity the 5 points that he understood to be central to Gandhi's practice of nonviolent resistance. The next year, he published Stride Toward Freedom, in which he expanded the 5 points to 6. So these are the 6 points of emphasis, the basic like principles of nonviolence, King's philosophy of nonviolence. And if you've been to protests and actions and stuff, often these are handed out to people in the group, depending on the philosophy of the organizers or the movement or the protest. So number one, nonviolent resistance is not cowardly, but is a form of resistance. Two, advocates of nonviolence do not want to humiliate those they oppose. Three, the battle is against forces of evil, not individuals. Four, nonviolence requires the willingness to suffer. Five, love is central to nonviolence. And six, that the universe is on the side of justice. I think number six might be the hardest one for me. So, though these points of emphasis are usefully distinguished, they're clearly interdependent. This is particularly apparent given King's stress in Stride Toward Freedom that nonviolence requires the willingness to accept suffering rather than to retaliate against one's enemies. King approvingly quotes Gandhi's message to his countrymen, quote, "Rivers of blood may have to flow before we gain our freedom, but it must be our blood," end quote. And then King asks what could possibly justify the willingness to accept but never inflict violence. He answers that such a position is justified in the realization that unearned suffering is redemptive. Now, I'm not saying that nonviolence is the only way. I'm just saying why it's such a powerful movement. And I'm just sort of getting to, like, this part here is like, okay, what, we're supposed to be martyrs or something? But there's a quote in here that I forget where it is because it's a long article, but I'm getting to it, that I think is really key, which basically, you know what, I should practice speaking in my own words, not just reading. The idea is that nonviolence is supposed to be transformative. You know, it's about the journey and not the goal, and it's about the means and not the ends. And in trying to be nonviolent and adhere to these principles of like loving your enemy, that kind of thing, that we are transformed. And the real goal is that those we disagree with, who we think are being harsh, that they be transformed too. That's like the real goal. I'm going to play, here's a song that I recorded at Mount Moriah Baptist Church in Middlesboro, Kentucky a few years ago when I was there.
I'm
back to the article about Martin Luther King and nonviolence. This is where it gets good. Okay. Through his study of Gandhi, King says he learned that Niebuhr, that's another philosopher, that Niebuhr's position was... Sorry, I'm reading on the computer, and obviously I don't know how to operate the computer button because I had it all lined up, and I bumped something, and then I don't know where it went. All right, so, because I was just talking about the 6 points of nonviolence. In King's own words, gosh, guys, I'm so sorry, I'm fumbling here. Okay, true pacifism is not unrealistic submission to evil power. It is rather a courageous confrontation of evil by the power of love, and the faith that it is better to be the recipient of violence than the inflictor of it, since the latter only multiplies the existence of violence and bitterness in the universe, while the former may develop a sense of shame in the opponent and thereby bring about a transformation and change of heart. King is quite well aware that such a commitment entails a massive metaphysical proposal. The willingness to accept suffering without retaliation must be based on the conviction that the universe is on the side of justice. King acknowledges that there are devout believers in nonviolence who find it difficult to believe in a personal God, but even these persons believe in the existence of some creative force that works for universal wholeness. Love, I'm skipping a paragraph. Love, therefore, becomes the hallmark of nonviolent resistance, requiring that the resistor not only refuse to shoot his opponent, but also refuse to hate him. Nonviolent resistance is meant to bring an end to hate by being the very embodiment of agape. King never seemed to tire of an appeal to Anders Nygren's distinction between eros, phila, and agape to make the point that the love that shapes nonviolent resistance is one that's disciplined by the refusal to distinguish between worthy and unworthy people. Rather, agape begins by loving others for their own sake, which requires that we have love for the enemy, neighbor, from whom you can expect no good in return, but only hostility and persecution. I want to repeat that thing where they say, the love that shapes nonviolent resistance is one that is disciplined by the refusal to distinguish between worthy and unworthy people. Such a love means that nonviolent resistance seeks not to defeat or humiliate the opponent, but to win a friend. The protests that may take the form of boycotts and other non-cooperative modes of behavior are not ends in themselves, but rather attempts to awaken in the opponent a sense of shame and repentance. The end of nonviolent resistance is redemption and reconciliation with those who have been the oppressor. Love overwhelms hate, making possible the creation of a beloved community that would otherwise be impossible. Accordingly, nonviolent resistance is not directed against people, but against forces of evil. Those who happen to be doing evil are as victimized by the evil they do as those who are the object of their oppression. From the perspective of nonviolence, King argued that the enemy is not the white people of Montgomery, but injustice itself. The object of the boycott of the buses was not to defeat white people, but to defeat the injustice that mars their lives. The means must therefore be commensurate with the end that is sought. For the end cannot justify the means, particularly if the means involve the use of violence, because the end is preexistent in the means. This is particularly the case if the end of nonviolence is the creation of beloved community. It should now be apparent why nonviolent resistance is not a method for cowards. It does resist. There's nothing passive about nonviolence, since it requires active engagement against evil. Courage is required for those who would act nonviolently, but it is not the courage of the hero. Rather, it's the courage that draws its strength from the willingness to listen. For the willingness to listen is the necessary condition for the organization necessary for a new community to come into existence. A people must exist whose unwillingness to resort to violence creates imaginative and creative modes of resistance to injustice. So when I'm reading this article, if you just tuned in, this is an article entitled The Weapon of Love, How Martin Luther King Jr. Became Nonviolent by Stanley Hauerwas from January 16, 2017. So when I'm reading this article, I'm thinking about So many things. I'm thinking about the campaign in Northampton to defund the police. I'm thinking about a lot of the protests and rallies I've been to. I want to clarify, as a white person, I do not want to, you know, dictate others' philosophies and methods of struggle who've experienced much different things than I. Anyway, so I'm thinking about all these campaigns, and like for me personally, the nonviolence methods, philosophies, theories really resonate with me because I feel like policies can flip-flop change so much, but like a deeper cultural shift, like creating the beloved community is what we're about, like trying to create like long-term values, like a long-term value system that values equality. Okay. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Aaron, do you have an easy essay? This is like one of my favorite easy essay by Peter Morin.
Yes.
The world would be better off if everyone tried to become better, and people would become better if they stopped trying to be better off. For when everyone tries to become better off, nobody is better off. But when everyone tries to be better, everyone is better off. Peter Morin.
Yes.
Oh, that was Frances Crowe's voice in the background. I was at her house reading that a few years ago. Blessed be Francis. Now, with all this talk of religious this, that, and the church and all, I'm going to switch gears, figuratively, and play a clip from a story about a church story. This is from Teresa Osborne, storyteller from Southeast Kentucky. This is a story she told at Pine Mountain Settlement School in 2017.
Now, you know, there should be an educational element to your storytelling, and here it is. Basically, first of all, I was a Methodist preacher's daughter, and that meant that every 2 to 4 years, they would put everything we owned into boxes and move us 250 miles, right? And when I was growing up, if there was any kind of a reptile that made it to church to worship with us, he was quickly either removed from the service or dispatched. That means he was killed. Yes. Well, I'm sorry. They just didn't. They did not want to worship with a reptile.
Turtles,
frogs, any of that stuff. Okay. And so when I got here, I found out that not only were reptiles invited, but they were the guest of honor in a lot of churches. And so if you get invited to a church, and it is not a Baptist, Methodist, Episcopalian, Lutheran, Catholic, something that you have heard of before, all right, then what you need to do is to ask these people in a very polite voice, do you take up serpents? Can you remember that little phrase? Do you take up serpents? Then when you get the answer, then you know whether you want to go or not. Alright? So, that's your educational portion. So do not forget that little phrase. Do you take up serpents? Okay. Now, my father-in-law was Paul. That's what we call him. And he was a rounder. He would fight. He would fight at the drop of a hat, and if you didn't drop the hat, he'd knock it off your head and throw it on the ground just to start one of them fights. He was a rounder. But he met and married a really nice woman, and she kind of squared him away a little bit, and they started going to the little church right up the road up here. It's about 3 miles. It's in the big S curve, and it's right up on top of the hill, okay? And there, they take up serpents, right? Well, Paul's wife has since passed on, and, well, Paul passed on also, but when the first year that I came here, Paul was just, he was on oxygen 24 hours a day. He was getting a little delicate. And he got it in his head that was nothing going to make him happy but that all of us, my husband, my four kids, and me, would come and go to homecoming with him at his church, which took up servants. Okay. And so I did not want to go, being a good Methodist, I didn't want to go. And it had nothing to do with their not being Methodist. It had everything to do that I didn't want to see the snakes. So, you know. And so I asked my husband, can we say no? Do we have to go? My husband said, if you don't want to go, we don't have to go. And I said, then I don't want to. He said, all right. And so Paul comes in there and he's I had a bad night last night. The doctor says I'm not doing well. I'm not long for this world, and I'm thinking about how I want to spend my last days and what I'd like to accomplish before I go on to my glory. I would really love it if you all would go to homecoming with me. You know, all of us as a family there in the church together. I could die a happy man. No, Paul, we're not going. He went on about 2 weeks. Well, it's getting to be, you know, winter time. He started this like in January. Homecoming wasn't till July. He knew it was going to be a long haul. And so, you know, he's like, you know, I'm still not feeling very good. Y'all wouldn't, you know, give me just my dying wish, because I don't even know if I'm going to make it to homecoming. But you could give me my dying wish by going with me. No, Paul. We're not going. So, during all this, my mom and dad came to visit. My daddy was a saint. He never said a bad word about anybody. My mama, not so much. That's a whole other story. So we'll just talk about that. And so Paul asked him, says, Tom, would you go to church with me? Why, sure, Paul, I'll go with you. My mom said, don't you even ask me. I ain't going. Okay. And so Sunday morning rolled around, and Paul pulled up in the truck. My daddy goes out, hops in the truck. 2.5 hours later, my daddy comes back. He's a little green around the gills. He's a lot paler than he was, and he's kind of shaking. And well, come here, Pat Daddy. We'll get you out of the truck and take you in the house. And he's standing there, and we asked him, we said, well, Daddy, how was it? It was different. And we said, well, how was it different? Oh, it was different. And no matter how we asked that question, and we asked a bunch, all my daddy would say was, it was different. Well, Paul had some success. He had scored a run, you want to say. And so he really pulled out the stops. I mean, it was no holds barred. Paul was going for the gold. Hand me some more oxygen. Oh, last night, I thought I was dreaming, but I don't think I was. I saw the angels spreading around my bed, just circling, waiting for me. They was going to take me to glory. You know, I couldn't die a happy man. I couldn't go with them because I hadn't had y'all go to homecoming with me yet. Please go to homecoming with me. Okay, Paul. We'll go. We will go. Let it up. All right. And so here we are. Homecoming. Homecoming is the time when if you have ever gone to to that church, or your mama or your granny has ever gone to that church, or you were ever a Sunday school teacher in that church, or if you just ever wanted to go to that church, you can go to that church for homecoming. And there's going to be singing, and they're going to be preaching, a whole lot of all of it. And then after everything else is over, all those women who are really good cooks will have a sea of food. There'll be so many different kinds of Jell-O you can't count. You know, I mean, there will be banana pudding and Heath bars, and I mean, you just name it, and it will be there. Every kind of shucky bean and tater and chicken casserole that anybody could ever imagine, it's going to be on those tables. But you have to go for the singing and the preaching and all the rest of that first. So, I had a plan. You know, you shouldn't make plans, because it's doomed to fail, especially because my plan was to get all of us up early. 2 adults, 4 teenagers, 1 bathroom. And we were going to get up early, and we were all going to get to church early. That way, we could go back and sit at the very back rows of the church, as far away from the snakes as we possibly could get. Right? 4 teenagers, 1 bathroom. This was a plan that was doing the thing. Right? So we were late. And we're driving, and don't ask me why I waited until we were driving down the road towards the church for this thought to occur to me. But that's when my brain kicked in. And I said, wait a minute, how's this going to work? Does everybody get a snake? I mean, are they going to pass the snakes around like the offering plate at church? Because if they are, all bets are off, I ain't knowing. You know, and my husband said, no. If you feel the spirit, if you get, you know, enthused, then you can go up front and they will give you a snake. Lord, I always try to do what you tell me to do. And if you tell me that I have to get so much in the spirit that I have to hold a snake, then I guess I'll do it. But Lord, if you're going to listen to my druthers, I'd druther not. Amen. And so I said, that's it. That's as much preparedness as I can get. Yes. Okay, all right. And so in we go. And of course, all the back rows were taken up by people who had more bathrooms than we did. And so we're down there, and we're walking, and we're looking, and we're over halfway up towards the front. I mean, we're getting into uncomfortable territory. But, and it was so crowded, we couldn't all sit on one bench, one pew. So we found a couple of pews. So I put the kids in the pew behind me. You know, good mom, protecting her young. Put the kids behind. I won't do that no more. Behind me. And we sat down in front. And so we get in there, and it's a real peppy, you know, service. And I'm just like, well, this isn't too bad, even for a Methodist. I get into this. It's pretty nice. There's, you know, there was guitars and drums and all kinds of tambourines. And I'm just clapping and going on and everything. And I'm watching, and they're running and they're dancing and they're jumping. And it was pretty good. I liked it. And then my husband tapped me on the shoulder. And he says, look up there to the front of the church. And there I saw these ropey-looking things. Brown and gray, and they were ropey-looking things hanging off the hands of the preacher and several others up to the front. And I asked my husband, I said, are those snakes? He said, yes. I said, what kind are they? He said, rattlesnakes and copperheads. Okay. So I'm very quietly, don't want anybody to think I'm in no spirit. I'm very quietly clapping. And so, and they have what they call a snake box. And so it's about 2 foot, 2.5 foot long, and about 18 inches deep, and about 4 inches tall, and it's got a little screen door on the front of it. And so when the music gets peppy and the spirit gets moving, they get the snake box out, and they get the snakes out, and they hold the snakes up, and then when the spirit dies down, the music's over, they put the snakes back in the box, and they put the box away, and then they get the box out, and the snakes out, and then they put them back, and then they get them out, and then they put them back, and then they get them out, and they put them back, they get them out, and they put them back. And this goes on for about 45 minutes. And then the preaching starts. And anybody who wants to preach gets to preach. And so we're on about preacher number 3. And it is July after all. And I had gotten up early, and it was warm. And I will confess that I was beginning to get a little doggy-eyed. And I'm kind of, you know, okay. And so all of a sudden, as I sit there, I feel this little tickle down the back of my neck. And I said, immediate panic attack. And I'm thinking, if you see a snake, a poisonous snake, you're supposed to not move. Don't move, because it'll bite you. And then I'm like, and I'm thinking, and if I move, if I spring and shout and jump the pew, they're going to think I'm in the spirit. And if it's not a snake, they're going to bring me one. What am I going to do? My husband had nearly crushed 3 elderly women on the other end of that pew when he takes a massive slide, because he hears me and he is sure that I have suddenly gotten in the spirit and that a snake is forthcoming. And so he's over here, and then he turns around and looks at me and he says, Teresa, what? What? He said, Teresa, it's Valerie. Valerie Osborne, that used to work here at Pine Mountain, my youngest child. It's Valerie. She's tucking the tag in on your shirt. I almost killed her right there in the Church of God and everybody.
She was tucking the tag.
And so I got so mad, I said, we're leaving. We are walking home, because our car was blocked in by every other person that had got there after we did. We walked the 1.5 miles back to the house. And that is the story of the first time I ever went to a snake handling church.
And that was Teresa Osborne, storyteller from Eastern Kentucky, Southeastern Kentucky. She teaches at Southeast Kentucky Community College in Cumberland, Kentucky, and I met her at Pine Mountain Settlement School a few years ago. The quote is, you're supposed to ask before, when someone invites you to church in that area, do you take up serpents? Are you listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP 103.3 FM in Northampton? Thanks for listening today. I think there's going to be 2 more shows of Out There. Actually, next week is August 25th. That's the last Tuesday in August. So I guess that might be the last show for Out There. But, you know, with COVID, I might end up sticking around. My plans are to load the shipping container with bikes to send to Trinidad on Labor Day weekend as part of the Trinidad Bicycle Osmosis Project. More information can be found on the Pedal People website under Bike Lab. And then my hope is to go to Kentucky to see my family, and at some point go to Trinidad if and when their borders reopen. Stay tuned for Madness Radio coming up at 4 o'clock. Also, Valley Free Radio has room for new shows. We're looking to expand our on-air personalities to include more youth voices, queer voices, and BIPOC voices, BIPOC meaning Black, Indigenous, and People of Color. We want to hear your take on new and interesting music, talk shows, social justice, environmental awareness, and topics that aren't typically represented on mainstream media. New show proposals can be submitted under the programming tab on valleyfreeradio.org. Also, if you want to hear archived editions of Out There, go to weatherbeard.com/out there. This is Dead Prez, No Way as the Way.
I used to go to church, but the church didn't quench my thirst. Mama taught me to put God first, but she never tried to block my search. I was curious, young but serious. Why is religion so mysterious? Why is black life so hard? They say you're not supposed to question God. Well, is it okay to question the pastor? Was it passed down from the slave master? It was only the truth I was after, but I never could get a straight answer. So I couldn't relate to the sermon. Put down the Bible, then I start learning about life. Didn't know where the path would lead, but I had to get off my knees.
My way might not be your way, but it's okay, it's alright. Your way might not be my way, but it's okay, it's alright.
I build with the five percenters on the guard within us, it's no limits. Studied the Matuneta from Kemet, all saw remembered. Smoke herb with the Rastafarians. Grew my locks, became a vegetarian. Following the Tao, filling with the Baba Lao's. Jewels being handed to an innocent child. My mind is a Buddhist temple. The truth is simple. I try to be principled. Walking with a warrior spirit. Ain't nothing like learning from firsthand life experience. I'm a realist. That's all I deal with. Respect and truth. That's all I build with. A child of the universe. My religion is life and it's just as valid. I strive for balance.
My way might not be your way. It's okay, it's alright. Your way might not be my way, but it's okay, it's alright.
I gotta admit, I don't know, in the end, which way it's gonna go. While we sit by the project window, instead of living off the land with my kinfolk. Is there even a master plan? An unseen hand, is God a man? Some say that's sacrilegious. Same folks selling us lies about Christmas, Santa Claus, and the Easter Bunny. Just so the capitalists can make money. They say God'll take care of it, but you a terrorist if you say the same thing in Arabic. It's so hypocritical. It's a miracle. Listen to the message in the spirituals. Wade in the water. I'm following Miss Tubman and Nat Turner. I'm praying for my freedom and headed for the border.
My way might not be your way, but it's okay.
This is Brian from Psychic Cyclone. You're listening to Valley Free Radio, WXOJL.